From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Nothing less happening than major war crimes. Responsible nations have to come together to hold these perpetrators accountable. And together with our allies and our partners, we're going to keep raising the economic cost and ratchet up the pain for Putin.
The U.S. received global criticism for its actions in the Middle East during the Bush administration. Our motives have been questioned over military interventions in Bosnia and elsewhere. So it's quite a fine line President Biden has to walk, even as global outrage over the Russian attack on a sovereign neighbor continues to grow. What are his options? And what grade does this administration deserve overall for its first year in office? I'll ask political management expert Greg LaBelle.
And I look at China and I look at Russia. Who can we give a round of applause for Russia? Yes. Absolutely, absolutely.
While American journalists closely watching the ever-growing conspiracy-laden theocratic wing of the Republican Party are far too few, there are experts beyond our borders keeping a close eye on these dangerous developments. One such observer is Annika Brockschmidt, a German researcher of war and conflict studies who authored the best-selling German language book, America's Holy Warriors, How the Christian Right Endangers Democracy. She also writes for Religion Dispatches with the latest article headline, "The White Nationalist Fringe Just Took a Giant Step Closer to the Center of the GOP." On this week's show, we'll get her impressions of the ongoing challenges our nation faces.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, government, and different ways of standing together. It was December of 2020 that the historic Middle Collegiate Church in New York City was destroyed by fire. This Easter, the congregation is far from having its home back, but will be celebrating at East End Temple, where Rabbi Joshua Stanton has been welcoming the displaced faith community since the disaster struck. In fact, on Easter Sunday, the two communities will formalize a relationship that's intended to last until Middle Collegiate can be rebuilt. Meanwhile, deeper levels of partnership and cooperation are actively being planned. In Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a two-day QAnon-soaked Patriots Arise for God and Country extravaganza later this month is drawing a large number of GOP candidates for public office. Anti-vax, anti-LGBT, MAGA preachers will share the stage with Republicans seeking governor, lieutenant governor, and U.S. Senate seats from Pennsylvania and Maryland. And in Great Britain, the past few weeks have left activists, including many faith-inspired ones, scrambling. After the government promising to ban at last discredited ex-gay therapies, leaked documents showed a reversal of that decision was in the works. After frantic lobbying and public advocacy, the ban seemed to have been saved, but with the exclusion of transgender persons. Rallies this weekend are planned to amplify both the scientific and the spiritual mandates for including this most vulnerable population in a much-needed, much-overdue ban.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, and some of you have, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, still can. Information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest. Greg LaBelle is our go-to guy for analysis and evaluation of electoral campaigns, as well as the effectiveness of the people and processes that make up our government. with deep experience in both campaigning and academia, as well as interfaith activism. Greg brings the kind of broad perspective that the times call for. And so, Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Weld. It's good to see you again.
The human tragedy of Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine has captured the world's attention. People are finding many, many different ways to help as individuals. But Greg, what can the Biden administration actually do?
That is the question of the era, I think, right now. Of course, the defining factor here is what we're seeing in Ukraine is no longer limited to military or an international affairs issue or a political issue. This is a moral issue. And I think the world, generally the world, recognizes that. And the Biden administration, I think President Biden has been making efforts and many successful efforts to deal with it as best he can. This is a classic example, Walter, I think, of competing goods. And these are all, when I used to teach ethics and politics, this was something I tried to spend a lot of time with my students on. The competing goods are two. On the one side, we need to find a way to help Ukraine defend itself in effective ways and to stop the encroachment of Putin's Russia on a sovereign nation. That's a good. And I think most everybody agrees to that. The good on the other side, of course, is the strong imperative to avoid a direct confrontation with Russia, a nuclear power, and the possibility of what might only be called World War III. So these are competing goods that the president and his people are dealing with as best they can. And that's really, I think, the challenge here. I think that Biden has done a very good job at reestablishing America's role vis-a-vis NATO and Western Europe. We remember not that long ago, at the end of the last administration, where there was very little commonality between NATO, European Union, and the United States. Biden has managed to pull together a coalition that so far is holding together pretty well. He continues to move forward while always balancing those two, I think, those two competing goods. It's a tough spot, and I think that he and they are doing a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. I think the other factor that we have to consider here is, you know, we always talk about when America finds itself in a situation, an international situation such as this, there's that old rally round the flag thing where, you know, everyone sort of gets behind the president and so on and so forth. Not so much anymore. I mean, we listen to people who are actually complimenting and falling on the side of Putin, including some religious leaders in this country. Mm-hmm. So it's that aspect is not there for this president to make this an easier job.
How limited is a president in the ways that he can act without congressional approval?
We're finding that out as we go along. I think that the president has had his hand forced in some ways in this and in requirement that he has to figure out how much he can do, because, again, there is such a going to Congress, it's a combination of things in Congress. There are, as I said, there are those few who will oppose anything that this president puts forth. But I think there are other factors at well among other members. And again, as I said, it's the question of how far can we go before we bring about worldwide conflagration? Yeah. How close must we get to that line? And so there's no real agreement. And we all know that Congress is not at its best in terms of moving forward, making decisions, working together. So the administration has been sort of forced because of all of that, I think, to make unilateral decisions as to what has to happen. And I think that they have done a pretty good job of that. There certainly are more things that can be done. There may be things that could have been done earlier, but we'll leave that to the historians to sort out, I think.
You know, Joe Biden has a long history on the Foreign Relations Committee. Yeah. I remember seeing him in Davos, and people would be hanging on every word he said because they had such trust in him. He also has deep personal connections with our military. How do you see those things informing his response to the crisis in Ukraine so far?
You know, I think back, Weldon, to our last discussion a few weeks ago when we talked about sort of Biden's first year in terms of domestic policy and politics. And one of the things we talked about at the time was that Joe Biden has a long history in the United States Senate, in the government, and so on and so forth, which is a good thing. He knows where a lot of the skeletons are hidden. He knows a lot of the players, but he doesn't know all of the players anymore. And I think we have to say once again that this is not a Congress that existed when Joe Biden was there.
Yeah.
So there's a limit to how valuable that experience is, which is why it's important that he surround himself, and he has, with people who have been members of the Senate, members of the House, since he left that body several years ago. So it's both a blessing and a curse for him to sort of sort out what's actually going on. And I think Joe Biden is naturally optimistic, which sometimes can get in the way of clear-eyed realism. And so he has to be constantly aware of that. And I think that generally he is, but I do think that that kind of trips him up on occasion.
There are clear religious and nationalistic themes that Russian rhetoric is raising in this attack. Do you think most Americans realize this, realize what's going on?
The polls indicate that most Americans do see what this is about. But there is a very vocal group or group of groups maybe in the country who, for whatever reason, refuse to either see it or acknowledge it. And I think as often it's acknowledge it as actually see it. We've got some media personalities, one in particular on Fox News, who seems to be lining up with Vladimir Putin on these issues. I don't understand what it's about unless, as rumors have persisted, that he actually is thinking about running for the Republican nomination for president in 2024, which is a frightening thought. I'm talking about Tucker Carlson, of course.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of factors that come into play. But generally, I think Americans do understand that they can't trust Vladimir Putin. And he's given us so many reasons over the last 4 or 5 weeks to reinforce that lack of trust with the obvious lies that he's told in the face of video proof in terms of what's going on in Ukraine. So I think generally there is an understanding of that, but it's not universal.
You mentioned the far right, religion-tinged political leaders in our government. How do you talk about being an American and being so, it seems like, wanting Putin to win?
I think there are two aspects of this Christian nationalism, as we've come to call it. And it is a question of how some of us can consider ourselves good Americans, good citizens, and be rooting for Putin. The other question, of course, is how can some of us consider ourselves good, faithful Christians and be doing some of the stuff and making some of the alliances that are being made? And that, I think, is the challenge. And it's a frightening one because I don't think we see it as much as we have seen actions by religious fanatics on the right in the past. I think back to the good old days, Welton, when you and I worked together. The Christian Coalition was out there. But the difference is, of course, everyone knew what the Christian Coalition was doing. Yeah. They made no bones about it. They were there. They were visible. I think that this movement of Christian national, this tightening of the links between this branch of Christianity, which I honestly am having more and more trouble even referring to as Christianity, and this extreme right political edge in the country, this increasing linkage between these two is frightening and is happening to a large extent, I think, under the radar screen. I was reading an article in the New York Times this week that I'm sure you've seen that talks about the use of praise music, of modern Christian praise music, yeah, in Trump events.
Yeah.
If there's been a president who is the antithesis of anything Christian in this country, I'm sorry, it's Donald Trump. So it does boggle the mind, and I don't begin to understand it. I often come down to an overly simplistic description of this as mass narcissism. I'm right, and the rest of you are all wrong, and no one's going to convince me otherwise.
Yeah.
There is a narcissistic aspect to this, but why it's linked itself the way it has with these conservative Christians and these, you know, anti-vaxxers and all this stuff, I don't get it. I don't understand.
Yeah.
How would you evaluate the first year of the Biden administration now?
What I started with last time when we were talking about domestic issues still relates. and this may sound a little facile, but I don't think it's facile at all. Biden gets big points up front for being the president of the United States, which means that Donald Trump is not the president of the United States. When I think back to what we have gone through in international affairs with the situation in Ukraine, I shudder to think where we would be if Donald Trump were still president. And I think it would be one extreme or another. I think it would be a Neville Chamberlain kind of situation where Trump says to Putin, take whatever you want in Western Europe. I really don't care. I just want you to be my friend. Versus the other extreme, which is I'm not even sure that we would be here to have this conversation. Yeah. And I don't think there's any middle ground with the possibility of a Trump administration. Yeah. So lots of points for the fact that he managed to become president and get that guy out of the way. I think that he's done a superb job, as good a job or better job than anyone could have expected, I think, in bringing this Western coalition together in dealing with the Ukraine situation. He has reestablished the role of the United States vis-a-vis NATO and Europe in general. That's all to the good. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the challenges for him now is to maintain focus. We love shiny objects in this country. And I think, you know, there will be a shiny object that comes around and the challenge for him and for the coalition, but him is the sort of the guy who pulled this coalition together, is to keep them and us focused on Ukraine for the long term. This is not going to end, and we know that. It's not going to end in a week or a month. Someone from the EU, I think, was on today saying, you know, this could go on for years. And we need to be ready for that and to figure out how to deal with it. I think the other interesting thing, and this is an incomplete, I guess, on his grade. The other thing we don't know yet is the rise of President Zelensky as a statesman, as the visible image of democracy in the world, is both surprising and it really shows. Well, one thing it shows us is that, you know, someone who was in the entertainment industry can actually be a remarkable international leader, unlike our recent experience. So Zelensky has sort of stepped into that role with remarkable skill and grace and intelligence. I think that one of the interesting things that the result of that is, in some ways, some of the more traditional leaders of Western democracies have been a little diminished just because of the situation. I think Boris Johnson, you know, he wasn't doing so well to begin with. He's just glad nobody's talking about the COVID frat parties anymore. Emmanuel Macron, Olaf Scholz, of course, he's living in the shadow of Angela Merkel. But I think these leaders have sort of become less significant because this person from what I think most people would have called sort of a second-rate country has sort of captured the imagination of Western Democrats. The question I guess we have is, if I'm right about that, and if there is this diminution, what does it mean and how does it affect the United States and the Biden administration in particular? And I don't think we know that yet. So there may be some sort of reordering of Western power structure going on here as a result. God, we're just in the era of reordering of structures, aren't we? I don't think there's anything in our lives that isn't in that realm right now. So, I think a good job, but still incomplete.
You know, the campaign certainly raised up bipartisanship as a central value for this president. Has he been able to do anything substantial along those lines? And has he had some opportunities that he missed?
Well, I'm sure there have been opportunities that have been missed. But let's look at the infrastructure legislation. The infrastructure bill is something that we've been talking about this country for almost as long as I've been alive. Dwight Eisenhower did the last thing in this country that really had a major impact on infrastructure in this country with the interstate highway system. And we've been sort of, you know, flirting with it ever since. He got a bill passed. And of course, what's the first thing that the Republican leadership did? They criticized and ostracized some of their members who voted for it and then went out and took credit for the money that's coming to the states. When you're dealing with that kind of dishonesty and a refusal to play fair, it sort of ties your hands. It makes it really difficult to work in that system. And again, that's the thing I think that the Biden administration is still trying to figure out. So while Biden has certainly made mistakes, he has managed to get some stuff through. I was happy to see that the House and Senate both passed more funding for COVID relief, although, of course, they cut out $10 billion that was supposed to go to international relief. And I don't know why we think that suddenly, you know, borders are going to mean something to viruses again, because they don't. You know, there have been some successes. I think we have to really be realistic about our expectations and keep trying. And I think that's what they're trying to do right now.
Greg, what are the most important things this president needs to be doing right now?
The first thing that comes to mind is climate change. Mm-hmm. This is a problem that grows almost by the hour to this country and to the world. And it is a matter of international affairs as well as domestic policy. They're trying to sort of figure out how to deal with that. I think we have to look at cybersecurity. I know that there have been some successes in the last couple of weeks in getting some of big business to sit down with government and sort of think about cybersecurity in the face of this new crisis and threat that has suddenly sort of reared its head. And I keep going back to Ukraine. I sort of can't help it. But I think the other big thing that the Biden administration has to figure out is, how do we deal long term with a Russia that has become a rogue nation?
Yeah,
that will never be the same. Not certainly not as long as I'm on this earth, will not be the same.
Yeah.
There are factors that these are in many ways interrelated. So, you know, it's a complicated set of problems. But meanwhile, again, we still have that challenge before us in how to deal with a Republican Party that doesn't seem to share a lot of the values that have been shared in this country before. I think of Ketanji Brown Jackson's hearings last week, the week before, and I think of Lindsey Graham, John McCain's best friend, and poor John McCain, asking Judge Brown Jackson, on a scale of 1 to 10, how faithful are you to your religion? And as a Protestant, could you be fair to a Catholic? How did we get here? These are seemingly intractable problems that we have to figure out how to deal mm-hmm. with. And we're going to be walking in the dark. We're going to be stumbling in the dark, I think, in trying to figure these things out for a while.
Yeah. I know the last time we talked, you were of the thought that Democrats are in a very bad place as we look at coming elections. What would it take for them to turn something around?
Democrats tend to struggle with messaging. We know that.
Yeah.
So we just kind of start there. This is always the question. What is the message? How can we come up with a message that is clear and that I always like to say sort of strikes at the heart less than the head? Because that's how voters begin to make their assessments. There is sort of an emotional thing that has to happen that gets them to somehow connect to the message and to understand in an emotional sort of way as well, answer that seemingly selfish question, but self-interested question, I guess. What's in it for me? How is my life going to change for the better if you folks remain in office or are elected to office? So these are the kinds of things that are faced. And this is, I can't believe I would ever say this, but a part of my hope rests with Donald Trump, because he alone has the potential to turn off droves of voters. And it looks like he hasn't figured that out. And I hope he never figures it out. He also has the ability, obviously, to drive up the participation of that segment of voters who still think that, you know, he won the election and so on and so forth. But I think increasingly we see evidence that his power is waning. That new TikTok thing, whatever it is that he set up, is a complete disaster. Yeah. It's a total disaster. And people are just sort of paying less and less attention to him. We see it in the polls as well. But Trump will not sit quietly by in the midterms. Yeah. So to some extent, I think that Donald Trump can do for the country what he did for Georgia in the special election right after the general a year or so ago. But it's we're fighting against history here. I mean, yeah. We know we're fighting against history. First midterms of any administration, with maybe like two exceptions, I think, since Roosevelt, have not been pretty for the party holding the presidency. So it's tough. It's really tough. The courts have actually, with regard to redistricting, the courts have done some fairly good work. They have thrown out some pretty egregious mm-hmm. proposals by Republican state legislatures and required a reassessment of that. So we're not in as bad a shape with that as we thought we would be. So that's a good thing.
What worries you the most about the state of our politics today?
Well, to be brief, and I've said this, I've told you this before. This is something that I used to tell my students early on in my classes with them. There was a time in political discourse in this country when if you disagreed with me, I thought that you were wrong. Now it seems that if you disagree with me, I believe that you are evil. Mm-hmm. And that has been driven primarily by the religious right over the years. I wish I could say that it has remained the mindset of just people on the right, but it has not. To a much smaller extent, there is some of that that exists on the left, happily not nearly as much, but it seems to be a given in our public discourse today. That in some ways is at the core of so many of the problems we've been talking about today.
Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University and Director Emeritus of GW's Native American Political Leadership Program and Semester in Washington Politics Program. And just like your host, so I can't say anything bad about it, he doesn't seem to be able to get this retirement thing quite right, as he now the interim director of the AT&T Center for Indigenous Politics and Policy. I understand. Greg
yes, you do.
also worked in several presidential campaigns and has held leadership positions at Interfaith Alliance. Thank you for taking time for State of Belief Radio.
It's always a pleasure and an honor, Welton, to spend time with you. Thank you.
Up next, German conflict studies researcher Annika Brockschmidt on the American political religious right. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. The Religion Dispatch's headline would be hard for us to resist. The white nationalist fringe just took a giant step closer to the center of the GOP. But on top of that, the author is a conflict researcher in Germany who recently published a best-selling book in German titled America's Holy Warriors, How the Christian Right Endangers Democracy. The way our losing battle defending the separation of church and state looks to observers overseas is fascinating to me, and so I am very happy to welcome Annika Brockschmidt to State of Belief Radio. Annika, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Welton.
What is the America First Conference?
Well, it was set up as a rival conference to the CPAC, to the Conservative Political Action Conference. And it was set up by Nick Fuentes, who is a well-known Holocaust denialist, white supremacist, and who generally has some very friendly ties into the sort of hardcore right-wing white nationalist and even neo-Nazi scene. So it was quite remarkable that there were a number of elected Republican officials who were actually featured at that conference, not all of them in person. Some had recorded a video message, like I believe Wendy Rogers and Paul Gosar. But for example, Marjorie Taylor Greene was there in person. And while I would say we have grown somewhat accustomed to Marjorie Taylor Greene's media stunts and her general anti-Semitic outrageousness, I think that was an escalation that sort of was glossed over fairly a lot by most publications. Some mentioned AFPAC, but I think it's an event that is seen as so fringe that the relevance of these people turning up at AFPAC and at sharing the stage, or at least the screen, with people like Nick Fuentes was largely overlooked.
Hmm. Well, what kind of people attend that?
Well, I think it is correct to say that most of the AFPAC crowd is generally on the very hard fringe of even the American political right. So you're looking at different extremist right-wing groups. You're looking at sort of the crowd around Nick Fuentes, who called themselves the Groypers. You're looking at open sympathizers with neo-Nazism. So they're not the kind of people that you would, for example, see at CPAC. They're generally not necessarily the kind of people that the GOP would touch with a pole, one might assume. So therefore, it is very telling. And there has been some very good reporting. Media Matters has done some reporting on this, for example, on the way that Nick Fuentes has sort of served as a bridge between sort of accepted right-wing ideologues and the hardcore neo-Nazi right. And so it's quite stunning to see Marjorie Taylor Greene not only turn up there, but then also nothing really happening to her in the GOP once this got out. So there were, you know, a few rebukes, officials like Kevin McCarthy and Ronna McDaniel saying, oh, right-wing extremism has no place in the GOP, but that was really it. So that's quite stunning when we think back to the kind of remarks that Steve King made only a few years ago that got him ousted with Republican votes from his committee assignments.
How does religion play into the themes of this conference?
I think what we've seen is that the sort of hardcore right wing of the American right, sort of the ones with open neo-Nazi sympathies or open neo-Nazis, they have started to embrace the language of extreme white Christian nationalism. So to a certain extent, that is not as surprising, because while I would say there's also a rather strong atheist notion, or has been in some of the extremist right-wing groups, there's a long history of groups like, for example, the KKK, seeing themselves as specifically Christian groups and dressing up their sort of racial, their racist rhetoric in religious terms. Now, that might look very strange to outsiders, but what was specifically stunning, at least I thought that, one of the speeches that you could follow in the stream of AFPAC was the one of Sepp Torba, that's the founder of GAB, sort of right-wing social site. And he did something that was so stunning to me that I had to rewatch it a couple of times. And I then reached out to a couple of experts, especially in the field of sort of neo-Nazi extremism and the crossover to religion, because he was using some terms that I'd only stumbled across within the sort of Christian identity movement. Now, I think it's very important to stress that Christian identity is not Christian nationalism. It's even further to the right, whereas white Christian nationalism believes that the US was founded by white Christian men, essentially for white Christian men. What Christian identity is straight up race war theology. So Christian identity followers believe in a Jesus who wants a race war. Now, Christian identity, it's a very, very, very small fringe sect, even among the right wing, which is what Daniel Harper, one of the experts I quote in the article, says. So this is even amongst sort of the neo-Nazi friendly crowd, this is out there. But Torba uses a couple of phrases actually from rather obscure parts of the Bible that you don't really see anywhere else, that are clear dog whistles two Christian identities. So one of those would be Synagogue of Satan. So he uses this Bible quote to sort of paint this big conspiracy narrative of shadowy forces. And when you say Synagogue of Satan, it's clear who you mean. You're talking about the Jews in big air quotes. Mm-hmm. And so this was one of the stunning points where you could see how open anti-Semitism is sort of clouded in, dressed up in very religious language. And I'll say this, I'm not sure if even most people in the audience understood the dog whistle. Mm. We have no way of knowing that. Doesn't necessarily have to be the case. But it was quite stunning to see Torba reference these specific points.
Annika, would you mind sharing one or two of the extreme statements that were made and how they represent a step closer to the center?
You always have the problem with sort of these very extremist statements. You want to analyze them, but you also don't want to platform them. But what you see is sort of a more mainstream Christian nationalist rhetoric. So the narrative that the US is being attacked by forces from within that want to see its destruction, that want to see the destruction of the Christian American way of life. That's, of course, referring to a very specific Christian way of life, into a even more clearly racialized and anti-Semitic version, because, of course, also Christian nationalism has anti-Semitic streaks. But I think it's important, again, to make sure that it's clear, even amongst Christian nationalists, this is not even comparable to Christian nationalism. This is neo-Nazi theology. And it's quite stunning that Torba felt comfortable enough, I would say, to sort of tout his beliefs in the open. Maybe he felt comfortable enough. Maybe he thought that the references that he was making were so obscure that it wouldn't matter, or nobody would notice it. But sort of combined with the anti-Semitic statements that had been made previously, for example, by Wendy Rogers, it's quite stunning to see that these sort of statements and the participation in an event like AFPAC, there are no consequences for it. Mm. There might be, you know, a stiff talking to by Kevin McCarthy. But what we see now, a thing that's actually sparked a lot more outrage than anything that we've talked about just now, has been Madison Cawthorn's talk about orgies and cocaine. Mm. So that's quite a stunning point, I'd say, for the Republican Party to be at. And I think the reaction of the party's leaders and prominent figures shows that these people who I think in a lot of media reporting are still being seen as fringe, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, she talks about Jewish space lasers. That can't be taken too seriously. But the fact that these people are accepted shows that they're being relied on for fundraising, for example. Mm-hmm. There have been numerous reports that a Marjorie Taylor Greene endorsement is actually being sought, a thing that you want to have if you're running as a Republican candidate. It's nothing that hurts you anymore. It's something that you should welcome. The Daily Beast did some great reporting on this. And so while I think a certain strain of white supremacy has always been there in the Republican Party, it's quite stunning how out in the open it is now allowed to be, when again, only a few years ago, Steve King got ousted for still horrible statements, but a lot less than what we've talked about today.
So we're talking about people who put on public display racism, anti-Semitism, pro-Putinism. Is that what you're saying, I think?
Exactly.
Okay.
And we saw this at AFPAC. I mean, there were Putin chants. Nick Fuentes, in his speech, said, oh, these people, referring to either the left or the media, it wasn't quite clear, who he was referring to, but he said those people are comparing Putin to Hitler, and they're saying that as if it's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he laughed because humor is one of the main tactics amongst the right to sneak in statements that might seem too extreme otherwise. And then you can always backpedal and said, oh, it was just a joke. I didn't mean it. But it was clear he meant it. And by the reaction that the microphones pick up of the crowd, it was also clear how that was received. Mm. And it's quite stunning that a Republican Congresswoman, Marjorie Taylor Greene, is speaking next to and being photographed smiling next to somebody who just got the crowd to do Putin chants and who favorably compared him to Hitler.
Goodness. Your latest book is titled America's Holy Warriors, How the Christian Right Endangers Democracy. It is available in German. Are there plans to publish it in English?
Well, actually, my publishers have done a sample translation, I believe, of the first and the last chapter, which has just been sent out to a number of American publishers. So they are in talks. That's only just started now. I know it's notoriously difficult to get a nonfiction German book translated onto the American market. But of course, we're crossing our fingers and hoping for the best. Mm.
Well, it's interesting as well as frightening that a German researcher of war and conflict studies finds the theocratic fringe of the Republican Party an important subject to study. Would you talk about why this is your focus and how historical fringe movements coming to power inform that focus?
Yeah. So I'd been following the sort of not only the history, but also the current political dealings of the American political right, which is a very sort of, it's not a homogenous group. It's very made up out of very different subgroups. But I'd been following that for a couple of years. And what I noticed, especially in talks with people here in Germany who are interested in American politics, and some of them even follow American politics quite closely, with the rise of Trump, especially, there was a fundamental, I think, misunderstanding of what the things that they could see happening in the news, how they came to be. Why do these people support Trump? But it actually goes even beyond Trump. Why is the rhetoric of the Republican Party what it seems to be at the moment? And I think even since the attack on the Capitol, within the last year alone, we've seen a sort of staggering escalation of rhetoric and actually action as well on the state level. Yeah. So there were a lot of questions. What I believed was necessary was sort of a historical deep dive into the history of the religious right in the US, because there are so many misconceptions, I think, in Germany, but probably also in the US to a lesser extent, let alone what was the motivating factor that led these people to mobilize politically. Most people think it's the fight against abortion, you know, with the ruling in Roe versus Wade, when actually it was their opposition to the Supreme Court ruling that the segregation in public schools was actually not constitutional. Mm-hmm. And so that explains, if you know that one thing alone, that explains a whole lot more why a whole group of people who call themselves Christians and who call themselves pious might cheer on somebody who calls all Mexicans rapists. So that was the motivation. And so what I hope I've done is sort of created a kind of a roadmap or an explanation manual, hopefully, for people to understand not only the way that these people talk and why they talk that way, but also what political structures they use, how they mobilize people, and why they're not interested anymore in capturing a majority of the votes. I think that's, for example, a very crucial point to understand. This is something we could see in the 2020 elections, that you had political commentators being sort of slightly weirded out by the Republican rhetoric, arguing about why this is not appealing to independents. No, it wasn't. And it didn't have to be, because the movement had decided in the 60s, if we game the political system that automatically favors us, we don't need a majority. So that was sort of my motivation. And now you ask what happens sort of historically, and what are the sort of lessons that we can draw from history when a radical group enters the mainstream. And I think what we see here is even another factor that makes this even more dangerous, because we not only have sort of a fraction of the Republican Party that was often laughed off as, you know, those are the crazies, they have to be kind of kept at bay, but, you know, there's one or two congressmen, that's it. Mm. Not only have they entered the mainstream, but we also have a situation where they see both their political and cultural sort of claim to hegemony fade away, and they feel a demographic pressure that now leads them to believe, okay, maybe gaming the system isn't enough, because you still need a sort of minimum number of people. So now they're taking action. They're taking legislative action on the state level. And this is something that's very dangerous, which has been also argued by a number of people who specifically, for example, study civil wars. And I think there's been some reporting on this in the last sort of months of researchers of war and conflict, but especially of civil wars, which is not my area of expertise, but of researchers of civil wars who say the factors that make a situation in a country very precarious, where a country is sort of teetering on the edge of still being a democracy, and maybe in part slipping into authoritarianism or into being a one-party state, not the whole country, but certain states certainly seem to be on that trajectory.
What would you urge all Americans to be keeping alert about similar nationalist, religionist movements?
Yeah, I would say the most important thing is to be vigilant, especially when you see there's certain buzzwords that should make your warning bells go off. One of them is talk about certain marginalized groups that are being villainized. So whenever there's talk about sexual degeneracy, like we see at the moment a lot when it comes to the LGBTQ community, when people are being villainized with specific vocabulary that you see in authoritarian right-wing, even fascist movements. Again, there's talk of degeneracy, be it cultural, be it sexual, and that those groups are threatening the children. That's a very common one. And that therefore, because the children are being threatened, and who wants kids being threatened, legislative action has to be taken, be it to, you know, be it to curtail voting rights, be it to get stricter laws, what's allowed to be taught in a history classroom, be it what's allowed to be taught in sex ed. This is all part of the same political project. So whenever you see those things pop up, and they have been popping up on the state level in a number of states, take action, call your congresspeople, protest, because this is not an automatic decline into authoritarianism. Something can still be done. So I think that's important in order to not, you know, get too depressed when you talk about this topic, that you have agency and you can use it.
Annika Breitschmidt is a German researcher of war and conflict studies and a journalist who authored the best-selling German language book, America's Holy Warriors, How the Christian Right Endangers Democracy. Her alarming Religion Dispatches article is headlined, "The White National Fringe Just Took a Giant Step Closer to the Center of the GOP." And we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Annika, it is so good to hear you talk with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Thank you. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.